Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
Listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with glam rock singer, songwriter, and keyboardist Art Deco. I'm Greg Cott.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. But first, we have reviews of some of the most anticipated albums of the year from Drake and Halsey.
I've been hot since the birth of my son. I remain unfazed, trust worse has been done. Man, evaluation, show me personal funds. It's the pretty boys versus the petty boys. Sold that already, got a whole new set of toys. This so surreal, Drizzy Drake, you better enjoy it. Nothing else bigger than the OVO Letterman boys. Cashmere knits for the nighttime boat rides. Ollie got the first edition parked up roadside. The only sign of struggling is coming from those guys. I'm trying to just relay what I can see through my own eyes.
That is a track called Champagne Poetry from the new Drake album, Certified Lover Boy, the sixth album from Drake. The Toronto-based actor turned hip-hop superstar, in terms of hip-hop dominating the 2010s,
yeah,
in the same way that his former friend, no longer friend, Kanye West, dominated the first decade of the 2000s. From a commercial and artistic standpoint, moving the art form forward in the estimation of many people. The whole idea of this expression of vulnerability, self-doubt, anxiety, a step away from that ultra-hard stance of so much hip-hop through the decades. Kanye got there first with 808s and Heartbreak in 2008, but he was mentoring Drake at the time, and Drake freely admitted that Kanye was the biggest influence on his life, and he carried that sound forward into the 2010s, enjoyed huge commercial success, 5 straight multi-platinum number one albums, 40 top 40 singles, 6 number ones, that's just on his own. There's an additional number ones with other artists.
I've read the number one streaming artist of the streaming era.
Incredible run of commercial success, no doubt. So what's his new album all about? This has been long anticipated, as we mentioned, although as per usual, lately Drake has sort of just been dropping these albums without a whole lot of preliminaries, and that's exactly what he did with Certified Lover Boy.
Say that title again.
Certified Lover Boy.
Certified Lover Boy.
That's right. That's Drake. Sixth album. Let's play a track from it before we review it. It's called Fountains from Drake on Sound Opinions.
How do you know the way I feel? You got me losing my mind. Oh. Try to suppress my emotions. They're bursting like fountains, baby. They take me down. I'm getting weak in my knees. Oh.
I got nothing to admire.
That is Drake with Fountains from Certified Lover Boy. I think, Greg, that is the best track of the 21 on this album. No thanks to Drake, thanks to Nigerian singer Tems.
Yeah,
really,
I like that track a lot.
Breakout role there. I tell you, Drake is 34 years old, six albums in. He's accomplished everything that can be accomplished in the music world in terms of success, and he still ain't got nothing to talk about but Drake. Far as the Drake era, man, we in the golden ages, he tells us at 7 a.m. on Bridal Path.
Far as the Drake era, man, we in the golden ages. Look at the total wages and look at the heroes falling from grace in their older ages.
Oh, you like the boy? Well, tell me what you like about him, he says on Way Too Sexy.
Oh, you like the boy? Well, tell me what you like about him. You a turnt a little thotty, ain't no wife about it.
Which may be, just may be, the worst song in the history of hip-hop. It rewrites and incorporates, you know, I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt by Right Said Fred.
Too sexy for this world, too sexy for this ice, too sexy for that jack, yeah, yeah.
It is competing with Girls Want Girls, which reads like a, you know, unwoke high school sophomore boy reading from Penthouse Forum in 1984, all right? There is just nothing but Drake telling us more about Drake. There is nothing but his mid-tempo mopiness. He has not grown. He has not expanded. And he certainly has nothing to say. It's an insult to hip-hop as a great form of storytelling. You know, he is at war with Kanye, okay? You and I reviewed Kanye West. We had some disagreement about it. But Kanye, besides talking about Kanye, which he does plenty of, at least was taking on the unjust, inequitable imprisonment of men of color versus white men, right? Drake has nothing that deep to say, and he samples R. Kelly. For the second time in his career, you know, he did it before, including some of Ignition Remix, and I forget what the track was. Now, TSU, the song that includes a Kelly orchestrated part, just instrumental, has been floating around since 2018, okay, according to the Drake superfans. And, you know, that is before surviving R. Kelly, but there is no excuse in 2021 when that man is on trial for the rest of his life in prison for sex trafficking and racketeering. You know, what's he thinking? I don't even think it was intentional. I think Drake is so solipsistic, can't see anything beyond Drake, that he just does what he wants.
Yeah, well, he can do what he wants. He's a superstar, right? And he is. At the same time, he's not really using that license to go anywhere new on this record, with the exception of that track Fountains, which I agree, that is the best track on the record by a long shot. That Afrobeat rhythm, the collaboration with the Nigerian singer Tems and with the Congolese artist Trezor, who is a producer on that song, co-producer. Other than that, we've heard this Drake album before a few times. You know, I think around 2011... he was an innovator. Take Care, I thought, was an innovative record, taking what Kanye had done on 808s and Heartbreak and extending it further. I love the fact that he sort of had that in-house production team, 40 and Boy Wonder, kind of creating a sound that was very much his own, kind of owning that space of vulnerability. And the guy who was, he was solipsistic, but at the same time admitting that he was frail and somewhat prone to you know, failure, and he was worried about it. He was kind of coming up, you know, through with some reality about his life, his family, and his concerns about going forward as a major artist. Well, since then, that has sort of become codified into this shtick that is repeated over and over and over again. And I was trying to think, when I went to see Drake in concert, I mean, the hits just keep coming. You realize how ubiquitous this guy's music has been, and I give him credit for that. But and I think why he's so ubiquitous, you listen to this album, it's very lush, it's very low key, it's atmospheric. This is hip-hop supper club music. This is hip-hop dinner music. You could have a dinner party with a multiracial you know, audience, and everybody just sort of loves the album. It's sort of in the background.
As long as they're not listening to the lyrics.
The lyrics are very, exactly. I mean, the lyrics, you know, he's talking about himself, as you said.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, I'm not surprised or even ticked off at that anymore, because that's what he does. What I'm really disappointed in is he's not taking this anywhere new, other than the fact that he has a father and talking about that on a few tracks. I wish he'd sort of extended that a little further. But the whole idea of a track like Girls Want Girls, okay? That's kind of like, hey, I'm going to be a lesbian too, you know, because I want
I like women.
I like girls
so
too.
So therefore, I'm a lesbian.
Yeah, say that you a lesbian girl, me too. Hey, girls want girls where I'm from. Yeah, well, girls want girls.
This is like seventh grade humor.
But even when he's talking about being a dad, it's in the context of Drake. He says in Champagne Poetry, I don't have to second guess nothing with no one I love. About to build a second guest house because we growing so much.
I don't have to second guess nothing with no one I love. About to build a second guest house because we growing too much. Think I got to scale the love back because...
You know, what's it like to be a dad? I need more room. I got to add a guest house.
Yeah, I got to find another garage for my numerous cars.
But what? Right said Fred. Yeah. Right? Am I right? Even Vanilla Ice would have been embarrassed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's saying something. Yeah. It's a disappointing record. You know, for me, the Kanye record was more disappointing because I had higher hopes for that. But I feel like Drake is just kind of phoning it in a bit.
So take what you want, take what you can, take what you please. Don't give a damn, ask for forgiveness, never permission. Take what you want, take what you can, take what you please. Don't give a damn, it's in the blood and this is tradition.
That is a little bit of The Tradition, the opening track on the fourth album by Halsey. If I can't have love, I want power. Greg Halsey is an interesting story coming out of Edison, New Jersey, not far from Newark. I know it well. Ashley Nicolette Frangipane, I'll say it with the Italian pronunciation, the chosen pronouns, she and they. I may just call her she for consistency. She accepts both. Grew up playing violin, viola, cello, and guitar. A huge fan of Alanis Morissette. Began to make her mark circa 2014 with a debut album and the single Ghost, right? Began turning many heads. And that audience just kept growing and growing. A lot of anticipation for this album. I've seen the billboards of her very striking Madonna-esque, Madonna as in the old, ancient Christian Madonna figure. And there was a trailer that went viral with her as like various French revolutionary Marie Antoinette characters and witchy goddesses and again the Madonna. Okay, she's got a top flight production team, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, his partner. They've been doing all of those soundtracks. Greg Kurstin, the pop hit maker. What is she giving us? Oh, I got to mention some of the many cameos. Dave Grohl, yeah. Lindsey Buckingham, Dave Sitek of TV on the Radio. Let's listen to a song. This is I Am Not a Woman, I'm a God by Halsey.
Every day I got a smile when my phone goes. A couple bodies in a garden where the grass grows. I take them with me to the grave in a suitcase. Maybe I could be a different human in a new place. Oh, I just want to feel something. Tell me where to go. Cause everybody knows something I don't want to know. So I stay right here cause I'm better all alone. Yeah, I'm better all alone. I am not a woman, I'm a guy. I am not a martyr, I'm a problem. I am not a legend, I'm a fraud. So maybe I can say you already got one.
That is I Am Not a Woman, I'm a God from the new Halsey album, If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power. You know, this was a pleasant surprise. I liked Halsey's music. I like it a lot better after this record. I think it's a major step up for her. She's always been an interesting artist. I think she's always tried to, you know, capture her generation's issues in song. She's taking on big subjects. She started her career rather unpromisingly with that song, New Americana.
Mm.
That was a bit of a reach, you know. It was just like, okay, we're all these things, and it was a self-conscious attempt to write an anthem for her generation. It didn't really line up with her personal story so much. And I think what she's getting at now is figuring out a way to make her personal story universal, and that's the difference for me in terms of their lyrical content. She's found a great collaborators in Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. These guys have been making great film soundtracks for a decade now together, yeah, in addition to their other work.
Reznor, of course, a veteran of Nine Inch Nails.
Absolutely. So, and it's interesting how Nine Inch Nails has started to bleed into pop culture. You mm-hmm. know, when I heard the Billie Eilish record, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? You could hear the Nine Inch Nails kind of references there. Not so much from, you know, you're looking industrial power, you know, this kind of heavy sound. More the creepiness, the eeriness, The sort of gothic undertones of it. And Halsey's record has got that too, and it really fits the subject matter. You know, those distorted emotions, distorted music, right? I mean, that's essentially the idea. Exploring the idea that what you love can also destroy you. I think that that's an interesting theme in this record. You want something badly, you know, whether it's love or fame, and it can turn toxic. So she's sort of talking about these heavy issues, and then at the same time, there's a process of self-discovery going on in motherhood. You know, the redemption is in that child. You know, having that child is the redemption. She basically begins and ends the album with sort of fairy tale slash lullabies. And the one at the top is sort of very creepy and disturbing. And the last song on the album is a love song to her son.
Because the longing needs the leaving and the loving needs the bleeding and your beauty is a blessing and I never got to tell you how. I love the way my eyes make yours look green too.
So you have this arc going through the record. But mostly I'm very impressed with the way she incorporated what Ross and Reznor bring to the party in terms of creepy atmospherics and combining it with her lyrical content. I think it's the strongest album of her career, and it's a really, really fine 2021 record.
I agree that musically this is a fantastic album, and she owns it. You know, I mentioned the guest stars, I mentioned the producers. No, it's all Halsey. She is, in terms of her having the taste and incorporating these different sonic elements. But Greg, I am not a woman, I'm a god. I'm not a martyr, I'm a problem. Ask for forgiveness, never permission.
It's goth, man. It's got to be dramatic.
You asked for this. Go and be a big girl. You know, these are like the slogans you would see on those hand-painted wooden signs in a candle shop. These are not feminist manifestos. This is not, I listened to the album about five or six times because I often want to have it on repeat, any new album, before I read about the hype and how it was made, right? I knew right away it was Reznor and Atticus Ross. But, you know, then I read, she has said everywhere that we'll take this down, this is a concept album about the joys and horrors of pregnancy and childbirth. I'm like, I just listened to this six times. I didn't get that. She really...
could be a red herring that she threw out
it
there.
Could be a red herring, but, you know, ask for forgiveness, never permission. Come on. You got anything else to say that is as deep and profound? So I went back to Live Through This by Hole, right? And a lot of people made fun of the overt mother's... That was an album coming out at the same time Courtney Love's Husband put out In Utero. I mean, the weirdnesses and complexities of motherhood and trying to retain your strength as a woman in the midst of giving life. On her worst day, in three lines, Courtney Love had more to say than Halsey.
I think you're missing the broader message here. I think that she is framing a lot of this, a lot of these arguments in personal terms. And yes, you're saying, okay, you could see this at a candle shop, but I think there's way more personal detail in this record than you're giving it credit for. She's very, you know, coming clean about a lot of stuff here, and I appreciate the honesty of that. And I also think some of the turns of phrase are really good. I mean, losing you is easier than lying to myself that you love me. You know, and it's kind of this whole, you're torn apart by the idea that you're attracted to something that's really bad for you. And I think that's the essence of the record. I think that's an interesting theme. And she explores it very well with the sonic arrangements that she's giving it.
Maybe I'm just not ready to be a big girl now. I don't know.
So we've got two big albums. We want to hear what you think now about Drake and Halsey. Let us know by leaving us a voice message with your thoughts on our website, soundopinions.org. Next, we've got a conversation with an artist who made one of our favorite albums of the year so far, Art Deco, on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He's Greg Kot. That's a little bit of the song, I Am the Dance Floor, by our guest this week, Art Deco. Now that is spelled ARTDECCO. It helps when you're searching for him, and search for him you should. Earlier this year, we reviewed Art's third album, In Standard Definition, and we became huge fans of his music. He started off in the Vancouver indie scene as a keyboardist and backing musician, then reinvented himself as the solo artist and persona, Art Deco, which is more than just a name. It's a full-fledged alter ego superhero.
That's right, Jim. When he performs, he becomes a glam rock superhero version of himself in a way. It's a tribute to artists like David Bowie and Mark Bolan. But beyond the stage persona, his music has no shortage of hooks and definitely makes me want to dance anyway. I mean, there's at least one track on here that, you know, when you're washing the dishes, it just time just flies by.
The whole album.
We're glad to have Art Deco on the show today. Welcome to Sound Opinions, Art.
Thanks for having me.
So we are huge fans of In Standard Definition, the new album, Process of Reinvention. A long-standing tradition in popular music, one that you underwent. You went solo in 2016, a self-released record, Day Fevers, followed up with Trespasser in 2018. I rarely read an artist being so self-critical of their own work as you were of the Trespasser's album, apparently. I read this quote, I had just written a whole album about being alone and introspective, and it was rather drab. That's pretty harsh, man. I didn't think it was drab. It was fine.
It sounds great to listen to. I gather you were more talking about a bad flashback to a bad time in your life.
Yeah, you could say that. One can deduce all sorts of fun things. I kind of kept that open-ended. I mean, those who know me and know me well, like no one put a gun to my head and said, hey, go sequester yourself, you know, in the Gulf Islands of BC where there's nothing to do. But, you know, in my case, I was taking care of a family member who was living with Alzheimer's. But aside from that, you know, I had all this free time and I just packed up my music life in Vancouver and I was seeking reinvention. Mm-hmm. In that 6 or 7 years in the Gulf Islands, you know, just like that old mob quote, every time I leave, they suck me back in. And I found myself, you know, buying, you know, compressors and recording gear and synthesizers and just building like an analog studio, just going into heaps of debt like I'm on some crazy suicide mission where, like, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to make this work on my terms. And I guess I call Day Fevers my practice album. Trespasser was for real. It was just a really depressing time for me. And then within standard definition, I finally moved to Victoria here on Vancouver Island. And so, yeah, every time I move somewhere, I feel like, oh, this would be a great place to set up shop and, you know, record a new album. So
I made a little joke the last time we were talking about your record. And, you know, I said, hey, this story about the black bobbed wig in the shopping mall store window is sounding like Art's version of Robert Johnson went to the crossroads and discovered the blues. You know, he sold his soul to the devil. It's kind of like that kind of
or Peter
apocryphal
Parker.
Story. You know,
I prefer to think of it more positively. Peter Parker and the radioactive spider.
Well,
you know,
yeah. You get this impression in your head. It's like this light bulb moment. But were you sort of building to this reinvention, this latest reinvention, for a while, or literally was it something that occurred in like that flash moment of inspiration?
Well, yeah, it was a little bit of both. So I think a lot of musicians you'll find in your interviews over the years have a tendency to be impulsive. You're impulsive in the studio. You're impulsive when you're writing. It's like, I got to get this down right now before it escapes me.
Yeah.
And I think that spontaneity really played into this particular situation because I just spent almost a decade of my life living in Vancouver, playing in other people's bands on other people's terms. I was the utility guy, I was the keyboard guy, the backup vocalist guy, just always grinding it out towards someone else's vision. And for better or for worse, I did learn a lot and experienced a lot of cool things, but I just was so burnt out. Now here I am creating my own band and starting from scratch. And I'm like, do I really want to reemerge as Art, the Art they remember me from, indie rock Vancouver scene in the aughts? No, I want to do something different. What's going to be my thing? Like, am I going to, you know, like, and I was just grasping for straws and, you know, like I was brooding in the mall one day getting my keys cut and I had a show that night, my first show in Victoria, my second show ever as Art Deco. And I was like, you know what? There's the wig store. And I bought this like $350 human hair bob wig. And, you know,
oh,
on my
good one.
Oh, the creme de la creme, you guys.
Yeah,
don't F around. And I was, walking to my car and I'm, you know, walking, cutting through the rest of the mall. And there's like a Nordstrom's type thing with, the perfume wafting in the shoe department and the, you know, makeup department. And I'm like, screw it. Let's drop let's go whole hog. And, you know, bought a bunch of makeup, had no idea how to put it on other than eyeliner. And so I just kind of revealed myself to the band after soundcheck, and they were like, what? Like, what the hell are you doing? And it's just been the thing since. Like, we'll be on tour, and, like, someone will be like, hey, great show you guys last night, and I'll be sitting beside the band. They'll think I'm, like, the roadie because I'm not in the get-up. And it's kind
or
of like...
the groupie, yeah.
Yeah, totally, the groupie. And, like, or at airports, like, hey, you guys in a band? Everybody's holding a guitar but me. And I just kind of, like... It is kind of Clark Kent in a phone booth in a way where I can just kind of, like, duck in and out and be anonymous and just this is the representation of who I am on stage. And then during the day, I'm just, like, a boring version of Art.
You know, Art, as a college professor, I've had more and more students in the last couple of years expressing gender non-binary and gender fluid identities. And, you know, I wanted to ask, as a student of musical history, and obviously you love the glam period, never slavishly, you know, reinventing bringing that sound onto the new record, but reveling in that aesthetic. And it seemed truly revolutionary when Bowie, on occasions Lou Reed, to some extent Mark Bolan, you know, played with gender identity in the 70s. Today, it is being much more accepted. I wondered if you had any perspective on that and the freedom that comes from saying, I am them, not him or her.
Yeah, and it's a really sensitive, delicate, you know, like the last thing I want to be is, seen as some sort of like transgressive, like, I'm not a shock rocker. I'm not doing this to like ruffle feathers. I'm doing it as an homage to my heroes. And it's everything from Blitz Kid, New Wave, New Romantic, all the way down to what they were inspired by, those aforementioned, you know, icons, the Bowies and the Bolins and the Roxy Musics of our world. And so now, sure. You know, back in 2014, 15, 16, when I was just starting to kind of put this idea together, it was a little less common. I think that revolution with gender identity and gender politics and stuff is really kind of in the moment. And it's I'm not trying to claim like I'm not ahead of my time at all. I just like, there are artists that really identify, and that is their brand. That is like, it's part of my music. And with me, you know, I really ought to be careful because I'm doing it as an homage to, like you said, glam rock and the 70s. And it's just, I'm influenced by that era. And I feel like if you're going to play ham-fisted rock and roll with loud guitars and blaring horns, you know, the last thing people want to see is a bunch of bro dudes in V-necks and like, you know, jean jackets. Like, I find like the masculine kind of like pub rock aesthetic does not appeal to me. So I feel like if you strip the masculinity out of your aesthetics, in my own kind of brain swirling around when I was kind of adjudicating these decisions, I was like, okay, this is how I'm going to present my music. I'm going to be a little bit more mysterious and sort of put it through the, you know, this character.
When you adopted this character right before this show, did it change the way you performed right away? Like, you were going on stage and suddenly you were this character instead of, you know, what you had been before that in terms of stage presence, persona?
No more Art the Indie Rocker.
Yeah. Well, there's a photo I was reminded of recently of the first show I played, which was May 2016, and I'd already had Day Fevers recorded. So it was like, you know, I had the songs, now I need to start playing these live. And the band, I was like, you guys need to all wear like suits, you know, think Interpol, think like Roxy Music, you know, I want you guys to be dapper. And so I did too. And I was wearing a suit, you know, everybody was like, that was fun playing in a, you know, dressed up, you know, I felt like I was going to the prom. And I was like, maybe that'll be kind of like my thing, you know, we'll be, you know, and I started putting a mood board together of like, you know, Bauhaus and like early 80s, like London and New York, kind of how kids would dress. And I was like, yeah, I could kind of go in this. But these photos of like men wearing blush and lipstick and dangling earrings was also interspersed into this. And I'm like, I'm kind of more attracted to that. I want to put it on. You know, I don't want to be like a guy going to an office job and the stage is my office. Like, it'll be fun to kind of, but what is my thing going to be? And I think I was searching and the light bulb went off when I was in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did it influence the way you wrote the music? I mean, it sounds like the concept came before you actually started writing songs in this persona.
Yeah. I have always been fascinated with production and how and arranging. And I feel like, you know, that old adage, a hit song, you can play a hit song on acoustic guitar or some banged up piano in a bar and people will recognize it instantly, no matter, even if there's no acoustic guitar or piano in that arrangement. It's just the melody should just immediately grab you. But where do you go from there? And I love timbres and how they clash and how, you know, analog synthesizers are cold and dystopian sounding. What, you know, what if we rub them up against an acoustic guitar or, you know, really dry 70s drums mixed with like a, you know, orchestral arrangement? Or what if you put in like blaring horns with fuzzy guitars? Like, so when you start making this little, you know, audio sonic pastiche of all the things you like and you put it in a blender and you force it through your own kind of tastes and your own sort of melodic sensibilities, it just, hopefully it becomes you. And so I just, moving forward, like the new album I'm kind of working on now and I'm going to record this summer, it's like, how do I start now? How do I take the last three albums or the last two official albums and just completely forget everything I've done and start from scratch? And I still have these habits, these tendencies of like, of repeating the same arrangement ideas. So the trick moving forward, and I think every artist, their third album is the big one, you know, that you want to kind of wow people with. So now, I mean, we'll talk a year from now and, you know, maybe hopefully I will have accomplished the reinventing the wheel, but not going too far from what I like in terms of taste.
Well, you know, always beware, Art the Critic, who says, you know, if I was doing it, I would do it this way. But since I need to invoke this sacred name and risk the bell from our producers anyway, you having mentioned Roxy Music and him coming up in many of your interviews, Brian Eno,
ding.
You know, I think you just get a set of those oblique strategy cards. I mean, I have one that helps for writing. You know what I mean? And whenever you're stuck or whenever you find yourself going to that arrangement you've already done, you pull out one of those cards. They don't make any sense whatsoever. Make the sound of water dripping from the faucet or, you know, get rid of everything good, right? And then you're forced to, you know, you try it and it means to you what it means to you and then you don't repeat yourself.
We had as a fun little game. They're fun and we had them when I was with Colin at the Hive studio. Of course, I come in with binders of notes and details, and the demos are very fleshed out. I record and I arrange everything, and then by the time the band learns it, you know, you got a real drummer playing it, not some hackneyed drum machine from the demo, and everybody's coming to life, and it's so exciting. There really isn't any moment where I'm like, huh, what is this missing? But just for fun, let's just pull out the oblique strategy cards every day. Let's put one on the recording console and we'll use this as some sort of like North Star. And it rarely guided us, but I love Brian Eno so much. He's, you know, an all-time great. And I think in the writing process, when you're really flushing out and you're hitting those dead ends, you're totally right. Some sort of weird abstract, you know, word of wisdom that means nothing to what you're doing can sometimes light off a chain reaction or some improvised, moment.
It's just like the wig, you know, it leads you somewhere you didn't expect.
or selling my soul to the devil for rock and roll.
Yeah, that's exactly. Good. That's good too. So making this record, I mean, it's extraordinary. The people that you tapped to come in and bring those drums to life, to add the saxophone, the violin and cello from the Vancouver Victoria Symphony Orchestra. I read an interview where you were talking about feeling like Brian Wilson, having the Wrecking Crew and the best of Los Angeles musicians at your disposal.
Totally. It felt like that. And to be clear, I mean, I was not comparing myself to Brian Wilson. I was banging my head against the wall. I feel like, why did you say that?
Your interviews, Art, are very funny, because every time you talk about a Brian Eno or a Brian Wilson, you were thinking like this or trying to do that, and then you say, not that I'm them, not that I'm, you know, we're critics, brother, give us a break here. We can say, we love your freaking album, all right? We're going to compare it to them.
Well, I did, and I worked with Colin, and Colin, you know, he's produced Black Mountain and New Pornographers. He's like the indie rock king out here, but most importantly, I don't want to ever sing in the studio again unless Colin Stewart is there. And I've heard musicians say that. He is the chillest dude. I mean, it, like those movie scenes where there's like the, you know, the singer in, with his cans on and he's in the vocal booth and he's you know, singing like what would become like the hit chorus, like, and there's a whole room full of people like clapping. Not true. Every singer is so self-conscious, they want like the least amount of people in the studio or within like a 1 mile radius of it. And Colin like is so relaxing and chill. Like, he just inspires the best vocal performances. Like, he will literally sit there patiently for hours while someone is just like melting down because they can't get the line yeah. right, and you forget he's even there.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Art Deco, talking about the fickle nature of stardom, Iggy Pop, and more on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back. This week, we're talking with glam rocker Art Deco. Let's jump back into the conversation.
I'm curious if there was a song, too. You know, we talk about the wig in lighting, an idea. What was the first song you wrote for this, for the record, for In Standard Definition, where you felt like, that's it, here's where I'm going, here's what it's going to be? Did you have a sort of a sense of that from a particular moment when you were writing?
Yeah, I think so. I wanted to write the album from a set of rules, specifically, again, you know, there's the Eno, the Visconti, the Bowie, let's set up, you know, musicians need rules, we need goalposts, and you can move the goalposts as things kind of develop, you don't want to stifle creativity, but for me, I was like, you know, going back to I'd written a whole album about being, you know, introspective, and it was so drab, I wanted to, okay, well, how am I going to get out of my head? Well, let's, you know, you're obsessed with standard definition recordings like film and 35 millimeter and anything analog. Well, that's the starting point. Let's record to tape. And the first thing I wrote was TV God.
Nightfall. It's on. That face is on the channel.
Like, oh, TV, broadcasting, you know, and then there was like already references in a couple of other demos that were really, really loose around, you know, a TV star giving up on his career, you know, songs that could be perceived as like really silly movie scripts in my head. You know, a song like In Standard Definition wrote itself quickly because I was like, well, what about, you know, just falling asleep to the TV every night. And, you know, I'm a bit older than my fiance. Her generation is like, you know, put on an episode of Friends and let's pass out. And me, I'm like, no, let's watch this, you know, Kurosawa movie in black and white. And, yeah. And she's like, that is so boring for me. And so she'll fall asleep and I'll change the channel. Just started to kind of manifest, and I'm like, okay, well, that's the rule book. It's going to be an album about entertainment told from the perspective of entertainers, people consuming entertainment, and just these loose script ideas, and it's just going to be thrown into this concept.
Mm-hmm. That song Desires, too, really resonated with me. You could read it multiple ways, but essentially the idea of the person who hangs on too long doing something. That's
totally.
Just the gist of it. Were you applying that to yourself? Were you saying, hey, when am I irrelevant, you know, or am I becoming irrelevant? You know, those kind of ideas. Is it autobiographical, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this is, we're going to get into how the sausage is made. It's totally about that. And, you know, it's kind of an old Hollywood trope. And they talk about, they kind of, it's the whole kind of context of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right? If you remember
right.
The Tarantino movie and, you know, DiCaprio is, you know, he's like on his way out. It's all about the 60s and it's all in then the 70s. And you see kind of like this progression of where Hollywood's trending and he's the old guard and the new kids are coming up from behind. And I
right.
remember in being in like my late teens, early 20s, when I heard LCD Sound System, I'm Losing My Edge for the first time. And I was like,
yeah,
this
yeah.
old guy's like 34, like, time to retire, old man. And now I'm like around his age when he wrote it. And I'm like, man, I'm like a grandpa in rock years. Like the kids are literally coming up from behind. And I totally relate to that kind of that idea. I was thinking of that game show host from the Family Feud that was a quite a tragic story, how he ended his life. And he had, I was just thinking of like the game show host or, you know, the mm-hmm. soap star or someone who's just in this antiquated, you know, old-timey Hollywood thing, or maybe the band that just lingers around too long. And yeah, it's kind of sad. Like Hollywood can celebrate the star, but man, when you're fading, it's really tough. And some people just have a hard time letting go of that lifestyle and that adoration, you know?
Well, it's an all-time question for, especially for, you know, rock and pop music. How do you stay, You know, you have that three, or if you're lucky, you have those 3, 4, 5 years where everybody's talking about you and everybody's paying attention to you. And then there's the time before that where nobody knows you. And then there's time after that where people don't care about you anymore.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a rough ride, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Little window.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also this weird thing that happens with some artists where, you know, they're like, there'll be someone 20, 30 years from now that'll, I hope, discover Trespasser and will, you know, like in a mm-hmm. perfect world, you know, maybe long after I'm gone, and it will be, they'll be inspired to start a band and it'll be like, oh yeah, I remember that guy from many years ago. Or, you know, look at Iggy Pop, like his music gets big, like 20, 30 years after it's released. In a lot of cases, you know, people discovered it. Like I remember Lust for Life had like a whole new lease on life with the soundtrack to you know, that movie in the 90s, the druggy movie, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Trainspotting.
Yeah,
yeah,
and
yeah, for
and,
sure.
Yeah, and it's like he and when you watch like the Stooges documentary, it's like, you know, they were just a bunch of screw ups and mm-hmm. no one liked them.
Nobody
back then.
Only Lester Bangs.
Only Lester Bangs and Cream magazine, and aside yep. from that. And so I find that really fascinating how some music is just so ahead of its time. It's like, just, you know, it takes a long time for people to get into it or to kind of like, you know, realize its merit.
Look,
let me ask one more question about the thematic underpinning of in standard definition. So there is the part that Greg was talking about. It's very Hollywood Boulevard, the star, the fading star, unaware of where she or he fits in, right? And but there's also a really futuristic sort of media criticism, I think, Art. Futuristic in the way your music is, but also hearkening back to the past. You know, the day job as a professor, I've had to teach some McLuhan and some Neil Postman. And, you know, in the early 70s, TV was going to rot everybody's brain, and everything was becoming superficial, was going to ruin the world, right? And here we have, you know, made yesterday, you know, the Miley Cyrus new record or the Olivia Rodrigo, which is all about, you know, what is my identity? Is it the two or three things I've created on the internet or in my music or on TV where I play somebody on TV playing a TV star who is a musician, but I make music about it, right? And it's this folding, you know, like interfolding crisis of identity for many people brought on by the net. But I was just thinking, you know, hey, this was old in 1970. The medium is the message. I don't, are you following me?
Waxing.
I might need footnotes on that one.
I know. I'm following you. You know, to be honest, like, it's not, I guess, in the record thematically, there are some songs, like the song The Message, for instance.
Broadcasting messages, my signal's getting lost. The end, when it begins.
That can be, and I've had a friend of mine was like, "Wow, you really hate the fact that we're all staring at our screens, huh?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not. I stare at my screen just as much, like probably as much as anybody." And it's not that I'm disappointed or I am judging society for being obsessed with celebrity. I just find it fascinating that here we are, all strangers bumping elbows in the human race together, and the people that we should feel really close to, our friends, our family, the people that we actually know, are almost superseded by the strangers that make us feel good on TV or in the media, the entertainers yeah. that we have no clue could be horrible and sometimes are really nasty people without any redeeming qualities. But sure enough, they make us feel good. They entertain us. They distract us from reality. I find that really fascinating. I wanted to kind of like shine a big, giant, illuminating spotlight on that.
Well, just remember us, you know, when this next, when the third album, you know, blows up like it is, and you're like coming to town to headline Lollapalooza, and we're making fun of you because you sold out, you know, then come, like, we'll do like a show together. That'd be great.
Yeah, we'll go for, that liqueur that they drink in Chicago?
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, we'll knock.
No, you don't
back.
Want to do that. You don't want to do that.
Let's not do that. Let's do something else. Let's do something else, Chicago.
You know the way Jägermeister tastes like bad cough syrup?
Yeah.
Malort tastes like really, really, really bad Jägermeister.
Oh, I chugged a mini bottle of Malort when I played Lincoln Hall last year when I was touring with the Temples. We had a show at Lincoln Hall, and it was I drank a Malort on stage, and it was like, yeah, it was like highly. Everybody's like, it's like really, we strongly recommend you do not do that on stage. And
don't
sure enough,
that, yeah.
I was gagging through the entire song. I could barely sing.
Yeah, yeah. I don't
there
know
you
where
go.
That comes from.
Oh.
Thank you very much, Art.
Thanks, Art.
That
was fun.
Pleasure chatting.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
That wraps up our chat with Art Deco. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Who is your favorite glam rocker and why? Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to dig up some more buried treasures, songs flying underneath the mainstream radar that we think you need to hear. And this week on our bonus podcast, we talk with contributor Althea Legospi about the organization Black Girls Rock and the latest on live music in COVID times.
Important stuff, Greg. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our intern, Sol Delgadillo, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.